super fancy. Willkommen bei Super Science Me, Wissenschaft und Fiktion auf Radio Orange 94.0 in Wien. Am Mikrofon ist Julia Grillmeier. This is a very special episode of Super Science Me. I've just come back from a trip to the US. I've been to California, and there in the San Francisco Bay Area, I met Rudy Rucke, science fiction author, original cyberpunk, mathematician and painter. Since I am a fan, and in his books there are a lot of critters and a lot of tentacles, Rudy Rucke and his work showed up quite a lot on this broadcast already. This November, he was so kind to meet me at his home and record this interview with me that you will hear in the next hour. We talk about tentacles and critters, of course.
We give too much credit to the brain sometimes, and that tentacles, they're very cool.
We also talk about futurism.
The thing is, science fiction, we're not really about predicting ways for people to make money. A lot of us are somewhat left-wing, and we hate business people anyway.
And life philosophies.
If you look at a stone, well, how could you say a stone is alive? Well, it has an octillion atoms in it, and they're connected to each other. They're vibrating. They're entangled. And so it's just an exceedingly rich system. Why not say that that could be alive?
And we talk a lot about science fiction tropes, for example, robots.
Even worse is sometimes when they'll have the machine talk in all capital letters. Like, you can speak English, but you don't know how to use the shift key. That's not too plausible.
The dusty sound pieces you will hear throughout this episode are from California Kurt's new album, Scriptures, just released on the Viennese underground tape label, Red Rites. I went to Arizona and California for research purposes, for a book research. And what I'm interested in for my book is this intersection between science fiction literature and contemporary futurology or futurism, so the attempt to make meaningful statements about the future. And this, of course, also happens often through storytelling and through writing scenarios. So before I ask Rudy Rucke about some of the details of his books, about his transrealist writing method and his thought experiments, I ask him about how he thinks science fiction as a genre and these futurists' predictions relate to each other.
Yeah, I'm talking to Julia Grillmeier here from Vienna, and she has a podcast there. And the question is the relationship between science fiction and futurism. And some futurists are quite well paid just for existing, and science fiction writers only get paid when they sell something. So there's a different kind of pressure on you to produce things. My friend Bruce Sterling, I've written a number of science fiction stories with him, and he often will consult as a futurist for companies like Global Business Network. And he always has a funny way of putting things, and he says, the companies that come and call in the futurists, they're the ones who know their business is dying and they're grasping at straws. The thing is, science fiction, we're not really about predicting ways for people to make money. That's not really something that we care about. A lot of us are somewhat left-wing, and we hate business people anyway. But one of the things with science fiction, often the process is, in a way, it's similar to futurism. I look at the present and my surroundings and what's happening around me, and then I'll think, well, what if I dialed that up just another notch, you know, just a little bit further? And that's sort of what futurists do, too. Another thing in the motivation of science fiction, again, I'm not really interested in predicting future business conditions. I want to find a great story that's trippy and that's exciting and that will maybe enlighten me a little bit or frighten me and amuse me. And I do like it to be realistic, though. And so then there is a sort of intersection with futurism that I always like my science fiction stories to make sense. That's sort of a difference between science fiction and fantasy. The scenarios they depict aren't really so different. I mean, there's people flying or people shrinking or people traveling in time or reading other people's minds. But in fantasy, you're not obligated to provide any sort of explanation. You'll just wave a wand or something like that. And in science fiction, we feel like we have to make up some sort of explanation. Though usually these explanations are only paper thin. They're not very logical necessarily, but it is a process that we do. And maybe I, more than some science fiction writers, I'm into that, the sort of making the science make sense. Because, I was trained as a mathematical logician, and I have a PhD, and I like to think logically. So, and the process of doing that logical theory, it's useful for the fiction because it'll suggest things that I might not have thought of, and it'll suggest constraints that I hadn't thought of. And it's always good to have some constraints in your story because then that's a challenge for the characters. So there is, as I say, there's this overlap from science fiction and futurism, but in many ways they're different because the goals of science fiction are more to create art and the goals of futurism are more to tell people how to make money.
Some people told me they really consider this as a trend right now, like the recent years. But I know you have been thinking about this for quite some time. So what do you think? Is there something new to this now or is it just more?
I think because science fiction has been around a lot, it's more the part of cultural fabric. It used to be more of a niche field for unsavory people. But now there's been so many movies and TV shows with science fiction themes, and there's also this element of future shock that things seem to us to be changing sort of rapidly in the world around us, the technology. And if we say, well, if we look at this science fictionally, it'll give us maybe a way to sort of step back a little and kind of look at the world as if it's a story and be able to somehow get an angle on it. There's also science fiction is really permeating mainstream literature. There's now really a very large proportion of the books being published now. They actually are science fiction books, but because they're being put out as mainstream literary novels, the high mandarins don't want to say that their work is science fiction because that's scuzzy. It's for dirty, crazy people. So they'll always call this work is visionary, this is futuristic, this is a great feat of the imagination, a huge leap of thought. And often it'll just be using a trope that is really quite familiar to science fiction readers. It'll be a little bit of time travel or some robots who look like people or telepathy, and the critics will just be slack-jawed and wonder that somebody ever thought of such a thing. And if you're a professional science fiction writer, there's a bit of bitterness on our part, a bit of resentment that we invented this stuff and we don't get as much recognition as we would like. This said, I will say it's part of the nature of an author's personality to be bitter and resentful.
Thank you.
There's a group in Palo Alto, and they're called Institute for the Future, okay. IFF, yeah, in Palo Alto. Yeah, and they're real nice people, mm-hmm. and sometimes they'll have science fiction writers working there, but I've given a lot of talks for them, and it was interesting. They had a conference, and so I was there talking about this story, and the people there were like, I think it was very expensive to attend the conference. It was, you know, like $1,000. And the people there were like, well, I'm from Coca-Cola, I'm from Hallmark Cards, you know, I'm from Shell Oil. I mean, people from really big companies are taking futurism seriously. Because, yeah, the world is so chaotic and nobody knows what's coming.
Because you said before, this distinguishing between science fiction and futurology, mm-hmm. you would say it's because you want like a good and trippy story and not mm-hmm. the scenario. But don't the futurists especially ask you and other science fiction writers for scenarios because they also want them to be trippy and maybe not this in this predictable, yes. plausible way, but especially because if one thing is sure, then it's that it's getting more crazy and unpredictable than we can imagine right now.
Okay, that's a good point. And the times that they've asked me to do like a story, if I make it crazy, they like that. And there's one reason they like scenario building, I think, because your imagination, it kicks into gear more if you populate it, you know, if you're making up a scenario, if you put people in it, then that animates it, and they're reacting to it, and you care about this story more. And if you just make, you know, a dry prediction, like people will use more solar power, and, you know, telepathy might be possible. But if you put a characters into it, then the story kind of grows itself, because then the people interact, and they have problems. And so it is a very useful tool. And of course, science fiction writers are good at that because we do that all the time.
I wanted to ask you about transrealism mm-hmm. because you said this is more like a mode of avant-garde writing, than science fiction. But I was wondering that for me, transrealism resonated a lot with what I thought was the more interesting aspects of these futuring things mm-hmm. because it says especially that when the characters are out of control or something happens that you don't necessarily predict or think plausible, then it actually gets realist because this is how the real world happens.
Yes. Well, that's true. I mean, there's always this thing that happens if, you know, that a writer's happy if your story takes on a life of its own and you don't really know what the characters are going to do. Usually, even for a story, I don't exactly know how it's going to end when I start it. I set them in motion, and then I'm, you know, continually thinking, what are the possibilities and what could happen? And then there's kind of a game designer once told me a principle that's useful in composing stories. If you have somebody and they're going to go from point A to point B, put up a barrier so they can't get there directly, and they have to go to point C first. And so that's kind of a composition principle that you use. And you can even then have a barrier between A and C. You can make it as hard as you like. But so that's something about making things, surprising things happen. Another thing I once saw somebody say, if you're writing a story and you think of some completely crazy, unexpected thing to happen to the characters, always do that. And that's pretty useful as a principle, too. You think it's going along, and then just throw something in and ruin it, and then perturb the system would be another way to put it. So that's a kind of trying to make a chaos laboratory, you could think of a story as.
Yeah. In your collected stories, you had this, I think it was 5 categories, right, where you said, well, my stories are either this or that. And one was also thought experiments. I think actually the first one was thought mm-hmm. experiments. How would you distinguish that from the transrealist writing?
Well, I grew up, I was fascinated by the beatnik writers and William Burroughs and Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg in particular. And there was this quality that their novels or their poems were, it was pretty clear they were in some way directly about their personal life. I mean, especially with Jack Kerouac, but mm-hmm. also with William Burroughs. And but then it wasn't a memoir because things weren't exactly true necessarily. They had warped them and made them more interesting, or changed them in some way. And I thought, well, that's a good kind of writing to do. And partly it's, for a writer, you know, again, many writers were very into ourselves, very egotistical. And the idea of being the hero of your novel, that's a satisfying idea. But then the other thing is the transreal is the trans part, where to make it unusual, that was the idea I had in writing science fiction. When I was starting to write around the late 1970s, early 1980s, it seemed like a lot of science fiction was, and it's still the case, was not really about well-rounded characters that are like human beings you know. There's a tendency to fall back on flat 2D stereotypes. And I thought, well, I'd like to write science fiction, but I'd also like it to be like a beatnik novel. So I'd like to have cool, kind of dense, emotionally complex characters. But then I don't want to just write a realistic novel. I mean, John Updike, he's, you know, I'm never going to do that better than he does. So I'll throw in science fiction. And then that's a way to give it an extra layer. And so that's where transrealism comes from.
And the thought experiment then was more connected to your research at the, or to your
right. Well,
being a
see,
mathematician.
Often I will do several different kinds of things in the same story. Mm-hmm. A thought experiment is, that's the what if. That's, yeah. You know, what if I could fly? What if I had telepathy? What if I could travel backwards in time? And then what would happen? And here you kind of get into that futurism scenario thing, because if you just say what if, then you say, oh, I don't know, maybe this, maybe that. But if you embody it in a story, then it becomes, again, it's Einstein famously used that phrase, thought experiment, and you start filling it in and having characters subject to these conditions, then you will, by observing it and writing about it, you'll observe the outcomes, which are not always what you expected. I was very interested always in the notion of robots having human intelligence. That's, you know, a very classic trope in science fiction. And then I was really pushing on this idea in the late 1970s, and I got my PhD in mathematical logic, as I mentioned, and there's lots of philosophical work speculating, can a machine think? You know, it's sort of a dead horse. We've just beaten on that so much, but it's still an interesting problem. When I wrote my novel Software, I was kind of looking for a way to write about robots that were intelligent. And by then, I'd studied Gödel's incompleteness theorem quite closely. I even met Kurt Gödel, and I was at the Mathematics Institute in Heidelberg, Germany, and I spent a year there just thinking about the philosophy of what is consciousness, you know, how can we have intelligence, and looked at it in a certain way. Gödel's theorem says that you can't, in fact, write down a simple description of consciousness. You sort of, a system can never really be as smart as itself. And then you'd have to be smarter than yourself, but you can't be smarter, so you can't describe what you're doing. And Gödel made sort of a passing remark. He said, nevertheless, we could cause such a system to come into being. And he was very concise. He would just say this, and then you go and think about that for 3 years. And I eventually came to realize what he meant was that, or what he could have meant, was that you could evolve intelligent robots. And now this is kind of it's a very familiar idea. And when I first wrote about this, this was not at all a familiar idea. It was, yeah. I was yeah. like one of the first people to even write about that. And because it's too hard to design something, but evolution, I mean, how did we get our intelligence? From evolution. So then I had the idea of letting the robots evolve and become more like humans.
Rudi Rucke published Software in 1982. It is the first novel in his Where tetralogy. It imagines potential immortality for humans through mind upload into a computer and eventually into a robot body. However, also the robots themselves, here called boppers, have evolved into sentient, conscious, artificial intelligent beings. They have freed themselves from their human masters and founded an autonomous population on the moon. Because on Earth, the fleshers, the humans who cling to their flesh bodies, do of course everything to prevent robot uprising. They, for instance, try to re-establish the famous three laws of robotics by Isaac Asimov. First law, a robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law, a robot must obey the orders given by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law. Third law, a robot must protect its own existence as long as such protection does not conflict with the first or the second laws. While in a more classic science fiction narrative, like in the story of Isaac Asimov, we would read how a clever human computer scientist fixes the intelligent machines so that they would serve us again. In this early cyberpunk novel, however, Rudi Rucke describes how the robots discard what they consider ugly human chauvinist priorities. And instead of some transhumanist utopia, the story climaxes with chaos, loss of control, and identity theft.
Traditionally, like in Asimov, the robots, they're like engineers, you know, they're boring, they're logical in the kind of boring sense of the word, they have no spark, no life. Even worse is sometimes when they'll have the machine talk in all capital letters, like, you can speak English, but you don't know how to use the shift key, that's not too plausible. So then I thought I should just go ahead and have the robots be like crazy people. And that was something I learned from Robert Sheckley, who was really my favorite writer as a boy. He's a wonderful story writer and very hip and cool. And his robots were always like people. And I thought, just go with that. Just have them be like people. And then you'll have interesting characters.
Makes sense. I wanted to ask you also about Saucer Wisdom. Was this for you like a transrealist novel?
Oh, yeah, it was one of the most transreal novels.
Okay.
I mean, the main character is called Rudi Rucke.
Yeah.
But it's all lies.
Saucer Wisdom was published in 1999. It tells the story of Frank Shook and Rudi Rucke. Shook is in contact with space and time traveling aliens who show him around in the future. And what he sees there, he then tells to the protagonist, science fiction author Rudi Rucke, who then writes a futuristic account of what Shook has witnessed. And indeed, Saucer Wisdom was itself long labeled non-fiction.
The way that book came into being was a strange thing where Wired magazine wanted to start publishing books, and my friend Mark Frauenfelder was working there, and he later made his fortune with Boing Boing. He started that blog, and then he was an editor at Wired magazine, and I'd written some articles for Wired, and he says, why don't you write a book about futurology, you know, a book about things that could happen? And then I thought, okay, I can make up a lot of ideas. And then I showed them to him, and he says, well, these are good ideas, but we need some sort of frame. Like, where did you get these ideas? Could you make up some framework? And then I had this idea that it would be cool if I knew somebody who traveled into the future, and he actually came and told me these, and he'd seen these ideas. And then it just got crazier then. I had this friend visiting me. He was a veteran of the Navy. I went to college with him. And he, at that point, had really long hair and a really long beard, and he's sort of a forbidding demeanor. And so I went to my pitch meeting at Wired, and I brought this guy with me. His name's Greg Gibson. And I told them, this is a man named Frank Shook, and he's a friend of mine, and thinks he's been abducted by flying saucers very many times. And he told me the stuff that I'm going to put into this book for you. And they're not quite sure, you know, if I'm kidding. But they believe me, because Greg was so forbidding. And then he suddenly jumped up and said, I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. And he storms out of the meeting. And then these people, they're like young editors. They're like in their 20s. And they're just looking at me, you know. They don't know what to think. And so then eventually I said, well, this actually, it's a scam, you know. But I think we should just run with it and say that Rudy Rucker has gone crazy and he has a friend who's a saucer abductee. And then I was worried it would destroy what little credibility I have on the literary scene. But I thought, well, I mean, this is what that guy who made so much money with the saucer books did. You know, the man who wrote all those books about being abducted. But then in the end, we decided to not insist that it was true. The thing is, at that point, then Wired, their book division collapsed, and they had paid me an enormous advance, the biggest advance I ever got for a book. And then they didn't want to pay me because they weren't going to publish the book, but my agent made them pay me. And then I went to Tor Books, and they said, sure, we can publish it, but let's not insist that it's really true. Let's just say these are thought experiments. And then writing it was hard. Eventually the book became a novel. Now, eventually, I wasn't quite sure it would be a novel, but then, because it's sort of like Nabokov's book, Pale Fire. It's a long poem with a whole lot of footnotes about the poem by the editor. And that book is actually a novel, but the novel is hidden in the footnotes. And so I thought that's a really cool way to do the book. So then I had, like, Frank Shook's reports about the future. But then on the side, Rudy Rucker, the editor, keeps having interactions with Frank Shook. And, like, Frank steals my typewriter. And just eventually he gets me into a saucer. And so it's a very cool book. It's the strangest book I ever wrote.
Yeah, that's another, I mean, also footnote on, like, I guess, future and science fiction, because it's the strangest book you ever wrote, but it's also the one that was labeled nonfiction for a long time, right?
Well, that's, I think, Tor Books, they made a decision to call it popular science, nonfiction, futurology. And at the time, we thought that was a good idea, but I think it's better to call it a novel. I think that's what it actually is, and I think it has more appeal that way. But marketed as science fact, people didn't know what to make of it. Well, first there's people who just hate, because it's called Saucer Wisdom. So then they say, all right, this is a book by an idiot who believes in saucers. So that's, you know, that turns all them off. But then the people who like saucers, they look at the book, and I'm making fun of them, you know. I'm sort of making fun of Frank Shook the whole time and calling him a nut. So then those people were unhappy with it too. So it's a very hard book to pitch.
Do you have like interactions with contemporary sci-fi and other writers that you find interesting, or what aspects of contemporary science fiction you find appealing?
Well, I treasure my friendships with other science fiction writers. There aren't really so very many of us, really only a few hundred at any given time. And, well, the old cyberpunk gang, like there's Bruce Sterling and William Gibson and John Shirley and Paul DeFilippo. I love those guys, and I always love to talk to them. And I collaborate more than most science fiction writers do. I think Harlan Ellison collaborated a lot, but I think I've collaborated more than most people. I've written with Paul DeFilippo and Bruce Sterling, of course, and then Terry Bisson and Eileen Gunn and John Shirley and a couple of others I'm not thinking of right now. So I like that. I like working with them and getting the interplay. I don't go to science fiction conventions all that much. It's a lot of trouble, and I'm really not in the first tier of popularity in science fiction. I'm always been a little bit underground, and so I don't meet a huge number of people there who have read my work or are interested in it. So that's not very gratifying. There's a lot of new writers coming up, and I'm not too familiar with their work. I mean, Charlie Jane Anders and Anna Lee Newitz. I just went to a presentation they did the other day, and that was good.
Charlie Jane Anders has just published the novel The City in the Middle of the Night. And in 2016, her novel All the Birds in the Sky came out. Anna Lee Newitz wrote Autonomous in 2016, a novel that also thinks about personhood of sentient AI and robots. Recently, she has published the novel The Future of Another Timeline. Together, Charlie Jane Anders and Anna Lee Newitz host and create the podcast Our Opinions Are Correct, definitely one of my favorite American science fiction podcasts. But now we get down to the nitty-gritty philosophical elements of Rudy Rucker's sci-fi writing and painting. Are you like a science-informed animist?
Yeah, I would even go further than animism. Mm-hmm. You might know I wrote a book called Hylozoic, and that's a Greek word. And hylo is matter, and zoic is alive. And that's the doctrine that everything is alive. And animist is sort of the same. It's saying everything is intelligent. They're kind of almost the same thing. And I think if you analyze it, and I've talked about this with Stephen Wolfram. He's like the great prophet of a new kind of science, a new way of thinking about physical computation as being, it's as rich as anything in a computer. If I look at like the leaves on a tree, and if they're moving slightly in the wind, they're doing something, a chaotic computation. And generally any chaotic system is, logically speaking, is capable of universal computation. That is, it can emulate any behaviors whatsoever, if you find a way to do the input and output. Another example I always use, if you look at a stone, well, how could you say a stone is alive? Well, it has an octillion atoms in it, and they're connected to each other via things a little bit like springs, the forces, that they're vibrating. And then there's a quantum field around them. They're entangled. And so it's just exceedingly rich system. So, I mean, why not say that could be alive and conscious? I think we get so hung up on imagining that we're the summit of creation. The world would be fine if we were gone. It would still be in a very interesting place.
Yes.
So Yes, I've always liked that idea. And the idea of the universe as a whole being alive, that's also an idea I like. That's a sort of pantheism. And I'm comfortable with that. It makes me feel at home in the universe. There was a man, Fechner, in the 19th century, and he wrote a lot about hylozoism. And he said, well, if you imagine that the universe is all dead and we're just these few spots of light, of life and intelligence, then it's like you're in this huge warehouse full of, and there's no lights and there's just this dark machinery there that you can bump into, and we're just fireflies, you know, in the darkness. And that's a sort of unpleasant way to think of the world. And he said, or we can take the daylight view of the world and we just imagine that the lights are on and everything is illuminated with intelligence. And I think that's a more pleasant way to think of the world.
So this obviously informs your writing, right?
Sure.
Yeah. How does it affect not only your perception of the world, but your living in it?
Well, I'm always trying to be comfortable in my own skin and trying not to be stressed out and trying to be... Well, there's the thing of remorse over what you did in the past, and then there's the fear of the future. And in the now, you can be compulsive about accomplishing some task. So to kind of uncouple from that whenever I can. I mean, I'm like anybody else, so I get hung up on the game, you know, and I forget all my good intentions. But if I can mellow out and feel like all is one, I'm part of the universe, I'm safe, there's nothing to worry about, that's a touchstone for me.
That's very interesting what you said about the world in itself being alive, like the cosmos or the universe. And it's what a lot of philosophers or like contemporary academics right now are doing with this turn of post-humanism. Are you interested in that at all, or do you have any thoughts on that?
You mean specifically, what about post-humanism?
Yeah, like this critical post-humanism that is not so much about transhumanist futures, but more about we become post-human by thinking differently about the world, not by manipulating so much our bodies and cognitive features.
I'm not sure I know much about that movement, but I mean, it sounds reasonable. The transhumanism is something a little bit different. That's like in Silicon Valley, people that are obsessed with uploading their mind into the cloud, which for science fiction, I think that's a very interesting theme. I wouldn't want to center my life around it. I heard a funny story. Some guy I know, he was saying his grandfather died and left his father, you know, a good sum of money. And the family was living in poverty. Like, the father said that he couldn't afford to send them to college and couldn't get them clothes. But he knew the father had all this stash of money. And he was like, what did he want the money for? And turns out he was using the money to buy a policy to get his head frozen when he died. Like, thanks a lot, Dad.
Exactly, yeah.
I think the idea... The underlying idea is something I was writing about in the Ware series, you know, or even in Software, was the idea of, can you extract your personality and create a reasonable simulacrum of yourself that would be, in principle, immortal? And that's, I think that's going to happen. I've written about it, as you probably know, I refer to that as a life box. And I discuss it, there's a whole nonfiction book I wrote, The Life Box, The Seashell, and the Soul. And I think we're getting close to it. And I've lectured on it. And here again, this is at, I think it's at Institute for the Future. I was talking at one of their things. And there are these guys from Hallmark Cards. And they say, oh, we're working on that. And from time to time I read about there's people that do this. They never acknowledge my work. They never mention me. But, you know, the prophet is without honor. Until a movie is made of one of his books. But so I think that's going to be a big, big business. And everybody, when they reach a certain age, they want to write an autobiography. They want to be remembered. And if we could find a way to make this fairly painless, and I've written about it a lot, so I think that's a technology. And that's the kind of thing I'm always telling if I talk to business people. You should get on this. This is going to be a huge business. But then they always look away. That's, I know if I'm making a really good futuristic prediction, people like don't want to talk about it. Like, can we talk about something else?
They rather use this intelligence for a self-driving car or for something similar boring, right?
Intelligence for self-driving cars, yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
I got to ride in one with Bruce Sterling, actually. We were over at Google, and they let us ride around for a while. It was sort of cool.
But that's also something that science fiction talks about, right? You have this crazy technology, but then it's used for something very mundane, very boring, or something very commercial. Like, I don't know, there's brain implants, but then it's the big thing to use it is produce rock videos or whatever.
By the way, the really great cyberpunk novel that sketches exactly this scenario is Pat Cadigan's Sinners, 1991.
Well, it's, you know, William Gibson's famous phrase, the street finds its own uses for things. Well, even the internet, it's still pretty good. I think that's, science people say, well, it's been dragged down, there's so many ads and, you know, spam and propaganda. But really, all in all, it's still pretty amazing. It's just, to me, that's a miracle that it got out of the box right away. I mean, the government and business never owned the internet. And they can't ever. It's just too sprawling now. It's too ubiquitous. And I think that's a really cool, positive thing. And pretty much you can publish anything you want to on the internet, you know. And the media, they always jump on these small, isolated things that are, you know, well, what about hate speech? Or what about revenge porn? And, okay, these things are terrible and they happen, but that's really not the overall gestalt of what the internet is. I mean, mostly I'm finding things that are interesting to me, art, literature, fiction, how to do things, and it's great, and it's free, and it's pretty much uncensored.
It was interesting that you started with the robots, because you also read or thought a lot about biotechnology, right? Like all this bioengineering, also in a less mundane way, maybe especially a lot of creature, a lot of new pets, like that.
I like to think about that. Mm-hmm. Well, Sylvia, my wife, she always says I love critters.
Yeah.
I'm always putting them in my paintings and in my fiction.
Yes, yes.
And she's always saying, don't use so many critters this time, but I can't stop myself.
Why is that?
Well, it's like this Bosch Bruegel kind of thing. I just like creating.
Yeah.
There's a phrase, it's an old phrase, sort of an old cartoonist phrase, eyeball kicks. So a kick to your eyeball. So I want to, kicks is a good time. And I like to put in eyeball kicks. So there's things, like in the old Mad magazine, there'd be little things in the corners of the frames. And you just see that, and then you're like, wow, that's something else. So the critters, they're there for eyeball kicks. But yeah, I think biotech, we haven't really talked about that much, but I think that is going to be just huge in the 21st century. And we're really just getting started with it. The thing about biology, it's always so much more complicated than you imagined. But if you read like a technical article, it's always, you think, okay, I've got it. And then they're like, but wait.
Yeah.
It's just so unbelievably gnarly. So we're still really walking in baby shoes there. And I think we could have all sorts of cool stuff.
In almost every novel by Rudi Rucker, you will find strange little critters. When I ask him that question,
I was thinking specifically of Transreal Cyberpunk, a collection of short stories Rudy Rucker wrote together with Bruce Sterling, including the huge flying jellyfish and a lot of personalized gene-modified biotech pets.
It seems reasonable to imagine that in 100 years we won't be using chip-based computers at all. It just seems it shouldn't be that hard to make living things that can act like a cell phone. I don't see why it couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm. So, talking of critters, there's also a lot of tentacles in your paintings, in your writings. Yeah, what about the tentacles?
Well, I like that kind of curve. It's mathematically, I've always been interested in curves that they're sort of infinitely differentiable. That is, they're very, very smooth. They're not just like a part of a circle or an ellipse. Mm-hmm. Like they curve back on themselves. And I like to try to draw them. I like seeing them and thinking about them. And I love on octopuses, they say that each tentacle has really as much intelligence as their brain. And that's very cool to think about. Because we give too much credit to the brain sometimes. Yeah. And that the tentacles, they're very cool.
Not only octopus, there's a lot of jellyfish also, right?
Jellyfish, I also love, yeah. They're mathematically pretty simple to understand what they're doing. And Bruce Sterling, he's always nostalgic about... We wrote a story about giant flying jellyfish. It's called Big Jelly. And even, I mean, that was a long time ago. It was like 20 years ago at least. And he still will always send me, whenever he sees something funny about jellyfish, he'll always send me the link.
I've just been to the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Yes.
And this also appears in several spots in your novels.
Yes. Bruce and I actually were there for... A conference of, I think, computer-human interfaces, and we were speaking there. And part of the conference was in the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and they had a big show of jellyfish that time. And that's sort of where we got into it, to writing that story.
Yeah, it's a fascinating place. I mean, I've also been to the jellies, mostly when I was there.
Yeah, the jellies, they're amazing. It's fun to just see. Well, there's always, it's a truism, but we sometimes long to see alien creatures, but we've really got some things here that are about as alien as you could want. And the whole deal with whales and dolphins and their languages, that's just such a fascinating thing. And, you know, we just know nothing about all these things.
You told me you're painting a lot right now, right? Mm-hmm. Are you writing also? It's fictional?
Writing stories now.
Okay.
I finished a novel. Well, the last novel I wrote was Return to the Hollow Earth. And that was, I finished that about a year ago.
Yeah, it's quite recently. Yeah, that's true.
And it actually was published before my novel, Million Mile Road Trip, which I finished about 2 years ago, and that just was published. And those two they're good novels. I don't feel like my quality has fallen off. I think they're as good a novel as I can write. And somehow I just don't have the energy right now to write another novel. I always say it's like you've rowed across the Atlantic Ocean in a rowboat, and then, you know, somebody says, "Well, when are you going to row back?" Just not today. But I love writing and painting. I like creative activities because then I forget myself. You know, the voices in my head stop and I'm just with the art. And any kind of creative activity is that way. You're just into the medium and it's fun. And you're learning. It's very satisfying. It's this corner of the world where you have control. And so much of the world is out of our control. And it's pleasant to have some place where you can do what you like. And the art. I mean, I've been doing it a long time, and I know how to make it look the way I like it to be. So I enjoy writing, but recently I've been writing short stories, and I might just stay with that for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, two novels in the last 2 years, I mean, we can't complain, I guess.
Okay, yeah, there's no rush.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Julie.
Das war Super Science Me, Wissenschaft und Fiktion auf Radio Orange 94.0. Diesmal mit einem exklusiven Interview mit dem großartigen Cyberpunk-Autor und Maler Rudy Rucker. Aufgezeichnet im November 2019 in seinem Haus in Los Gatos in der San Francisco Bay Area. Alle Ausgaben von Super Science Me können im CBA-Archiv der Freien Radios sowie als Podcast im Internet nachgehört werden. Alle Infos auf o94.at und ihr findet uns auch auf Twitter, Instagram und Facebook. Auch Rudy Rucker ist auf Twitter zu finden, und zwar als Rudy the Healer, und er hat auch einen eigenen Podcast und eine Webseite mit ganz viel Notizen zu seinen Werken und Infos zu seinen Paintings unter www.rudyrucker.com. Super Science Me gibt es wieder am 14. Jänner, diesmal mit dem lang angekündigten, lang erwarteten Thema, Stichwort Klärschlamm. Julia Grillmeier sagt, danke fürs Zuhören und bis bald bei Super Science Me.